From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Violence has erupted across Iraq. As many as 1,600 Iraqis have been killed in Fallujah alone, up to 800 of them civilians. U.S. soldiers executed unarmed Iraqis have been caught on tape. Eight organizations fear a humanitarian disaster. We'll go to Iraq to get a report, and we'll hear from Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani.
This resistance began with the massacre of April 28, 2003, when parents and children in a school which had been occupied by American soldiers had started demonstrating, and 18 of them were killed in cold blood, 60 were injured, and began the resistance to the U.S. occupation in Fallujah. Before that, not a bullet had been fired.
Also, is the GOP rewriting House rules to protect Majority Leader Tom DeLay? We'll speak with DeLay biographer Lou DeBose.
Yesterday, the House Republican Conference in Washington did something to protect the leader that they didn't think they would ever have to do. They passed a rule that allowed Tom DeLay to hold power, any of their leaders to hold power while they're indicted. DeLay's in real trouble in Texas, and they're trying to protect him in Washington.
And this month marks the 25th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre, when 40 Ku Klux Klansmen and American Nazis opened fire on an anti-Klan demonstration in Greensboro, North Carolina. Five people were killed. No one was convicted. 25 years later, survivors are forming the country's first Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We'll speak with two of the survivors. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least two dozen people have died in fighting across the country over the past day. In the town of Baji, a suicide car bomber hit a U.S. convoy, killing 10 people, injuring 12. In Ramadi, at least seven people have died, and some 60 Iraqi police officers were kidnapped for several hours Wednesday near the Jordanian border. Although the U.S. claims it has control of Fallujah, fighting continues in the Sunni city. On Wednesday, U.S. warplanes again bombed portions of the city. The New York Times is reporting Marine intelligence officials have issued a report warning any significant withdrawal of troops from Fallujah would help strengthen the Iraqi resistance. The U.S. currently has about 12,000 troops stationed in and around Fallujah. 47 Iraqi national parties have announced they will boycott January's elections. Most of the parties are Sunni and connected to the Association of Muslim Scholars. But the group includes eight Shiite parties, one Christian party, one Communist party, and the Iraqi Turkmen Front. Journalist Mazen Ghazi reports the parties issued a communique that charges the election does not speak for the Iraqi people as long as it is imposed by the U.S.-backed interim government. In other Iraq news, Agence France-Presse is reporting as many as 12 NATO nations are refusing to send military advisors to help the NATO-sponsored trainings. The U.S. death toll in Iraq has now topped 1,200. November has already become the second deadliest month for U.S. troops since the invasion was launched. So far, nearly 100 troops have died this month. Meanwhile, French President Jacques Chirac continues to voice criticism of the U.S. invasion. He said Wednesday there's no doubt there's been an increase in terrorism, and one of the origins of that has been the situation in Iraq. I am not at all sure that one can say that the world is safer. And the group Reporters Without Borders is calling on the U.S. to release a correspondent with the Arabic television station Al Arabiya, who's been detained since last Thursday. Abdelkader al-Sadi was picked up in Fallujah, where he was attempting to report on the U.S. assault as an unembedded reporter. The Bush administration has begun suggesting again that Iran is working to develop nuclear weapons and that it is determined to acquire a nuclear bomb. On Wednesday, Secretary of State General Colin Powell said, quote, "I have seen some information that would suggest that they have been actively working on delivery systems. You don't have a weapon until you put it in something that can deliver a weapon." Powell's comments came just days after the International Atomic Energy Agency said it had not seen any information that Iran had conducted weapons-related work. Also this week, Iran agreed with Britain, France, and Germany to suspend its uranium enrichment program. In this news from the Gaza Strip, the Israeli military has killed three Egyptian police officers near the Israeli border after they were mistaken for Palestinians. They were shot dead by an Israeli tank. Israel Prime Minister Ariel Sharon apologized for the deaths in a phone call to Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Haaretz reports Mubarak thanked Sharon and said Egypt accepts the apology and understands the incident was a mistake. The Israeli military described the shooting as a, quote, professional and operational mishap. Meanwhile, Israel Radio is reporting Elliot Abrams has become the leading candidate to become the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. Abrams is seen as a strong backer of Ariel Sharon's government and is closely allied with the neoconservative movement in Washington. In 1991, Abrams was indicted by the Iran-Contra special prosecutor for giving false testimony about his role in illicitly raising money for the Contras. He pleaded guilty to two lesser offenses. He was then pardoned by President George H.W. Bush in 1992. Police in Chile have arrested between 300 and 500 people following protests ahead of an economic forum which will be attended by President Bush. Police fired water cannons and tear gas at the demonstrators who had set up barricades in the streets. The demonstrations were seen as much as a protest against President Bush as against this week's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Santiago. Protesters in the street could be heard shouting, "Get out of here, Bush. We don't want to be an American colony." Meanwhile, in Argentina, bombs exploded at three separate banks Wednesday, killing one bank guard. No group took responsibility for the blast. Two of the banks were operated by Citibank. It was the third attack on banks in Argentina this year. Banks have been the frequent target of protests since 2001 following the country's economic collapse. In news from Haiti, the U.S.-backed interim government appears to be closer to issuing an arrest warrant for the country's ousted president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup in February. The Chinese news agency Xinhua is reporting the interim government has announced the U.S., French, and Canadian governments have all expressed their support for issuing an international arrest warrant for Aristide, who is living in exile in South Africa. In news from Capitol Hill, House Republicans have rewritten the House rules to allow Majority Leader Tom DeLay to keep his leadership position even if he is indicted by a grand jury in Texas. In September, a Texas grand jury indicted three political operatives with ties to DeLay, as well as eight companies that made donations to a political action committee created with the help of DeLay. In other news from the Hill, the Republican-controlled Senate voted Wednesday to increase the nation's federal debt by $800 billion, raising the new debt ceiling to $8.2 trillion. The federal debt has increased by $1.4 trillion over the past 4 years. President Bush has nominated Margaret Spellings to become the country's new Secretary of Education. Spellings has been working as the White House domestic political advisor. Before that, Spellings worked as an advisor to Bush in Texas. Bush also appointed longtime friend and another Texan, Harriet Mears, to be the chief White House counsel to replace Alberto Gonzalez, who's been nominated for attorney general. Mears has been serving as deputy chief of staff. Both nominations continue the recent trend of President Bush only nominating longtime loyalists to top positions for his second term. In business news, Kmart has announced it's buying Sears for $11 billion. Together, the two chain stores will become the nation's third largest retailer, but it will remain far smaller than Walmart. It's estimated Walmart sales will still be five times larger than the merged Kmart-Sears company. Victor Jara, the Chilean singer, singing Hasta Siempre here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Widespread violence continues across Iraq, particularly in the Sunni areas of the country. In the town of Baji, north of Baghdad, as many as 18 Iraqis died when a suicide bomber rammed his vehicle into a U.S. military convoy and troops opened fire. U.S. forces sealed off Baji's oil refinery, which is the largest in Iraq. In Ramadi, 10 Iraqis were killed in clashes between U.S. troops and the Iraqi resistance. Roadside bombs also killed at least three Iraqis in Kirkuk and Baghdad. In a chilling incident, as many as 31 Iraqi police trainees were kidnapped from their hotel in the western town of Rutba near the Jordanian border. Neither Iraqi nor U.S. officials could immediately confirm the incident. If true, the abduction would be the biggest seizure of government forces to date. In Mosul, Iraq's third largest city, the provincial governor's office came under attack, killing one of his bodyguards and wounding four more. Violence erupted in Mosul after the U.S. assault on Fallujah began 10 days ago. Meanwhile, warplanes continue to strike targets in Fallujah, though the U.S. maintains that most of the city is now under their control. Mortar fire and heavy explosive rounds targeted areas where the U.S. believes resistance fighters are still hiding. Residents have been trying to collect their dead between upsurges in the fighting. The continuing violence across Iraq and the U.S. assault on Fallujah have made November one of the deadliest months in Iraq. While there is no tally of Iraqi casualties, as many as 1,600 Iraqis, 800 of them civilian, were killed in a 10-day period in Fallujah alone. The number of American soldiers killed this month has reached almost 100, making it the second bloodiest month for U.S. troops since the invasion. This comes as 47 Iraqi political parties have announced they will boycott the planned elections in January, saying continued U.S. assaults are an obstacle to political participation, calling the Fallujah offensive a, quote, genocide. Back in Washington, White House correspondent Russell McKiber asked Press Secretary Scott McClellan about the legality of the Iraq invasion.
Kofi Annan in September said that the war in Iraq is an illegal war. If it's an illegal war, then the 100,000 who died there, according to the Johns Hopkins School, are victims of war crimes. Now, the president is going to Canada later this year, and the largest circulation newspaper in Canada yesterday wrote a column, printed a column titled, Should Canada Indict Bush?, raising the question of a war crimes prosecution. They have a war crimes law in Canada. I'm wondering, has the general counsel, has the president's
question, or is this just a statement of opinion?
Question, has the White House counsel looked at the president's legal exposure to a war crimes prosecution?
Russ, I think that it's a ridiculous question that you bring up. You were out on the Nader campaign, I think, at the time when this issue came up, and we addressed it at that time, and I'm not going to go back through it again.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan responding to Russell Mokyber at the White House press briefing yesterday. We now go to Iraq to speak with Dar Jamal, an independent reporter. He is unembedded. He is in Baghdad. He publishes his reports on a blog called DarJamalIraq.com. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dar.
Thanks again for having me, Amy.
Well, what is the latest in Fallujah, Baghdad, around the country that you understand?
Well, extreme violence and instability persist for yet another day throughout Iraq. In Fallujah, there are reports of continued very heavy fighting while the military contends that they now occupy the entire city and are bringing it under control. They still pound sections of it with heavy artillery and mortars, and there continues to be reports of fierce but sporadic fighting throughout different parts of the city from different refugees who continue to emerge. Also up in Mosul, as we see the military operation there has gone so well, we have continued fighting. Ramadi, more fighting. Beji, there's been fighting for the last 24 hours off and on. And in Baghdad, actually, there was a very heavy gun battle just down the street while I was listening to your report here on the broadcast. And also, we had our daily car bomb in Baghdad when a suicide bomber ran his truck into a convoy in front of the Yarmouk. A U.S. patrol in front of the Yarmouk police station here. Mortar blasts continue sporadically into the green zone, and there have been other attacks on a couple of patrols in different parts of the city today as well.
You have written a story on your blog about a 12-year-old named Fatima Haruz. Can you talk about her?
Yes, I was in Yarmouk Hospital 2 days ago, and just going from room to room, interviewing different people who had been brought there with injuries. This particular girl had been brought in. She's 12 years old, and she had received wounds. She lives in Latafia, which is a small city just to the south of Baghdad. And her home was raided by U.S. soldiers. They suspected resistance fighters there. Of course, there were none in this particular home. And, of course, they shot in the door before going inside. And both of her shins were shattered by bullets. And she also received a shrapnel wound in her abdomen as well. Another of her uncle was killed when this occurred, and another family member was wounded. Their home was, as her mother described, ransacked by soldiers. And, of course, they found no weapons or no resistance fighters. But then when the troops left her home, they killed all of the family's chickens on the way out. The family was absolutely in shock. While this isn't certainly an unknown occurrence in Iraq, this sort of heavy-handed treatment has been going on for quite some time now, sporadically around the country. But yet people... her mother, who was explaining the situation as well, it just had this look of disbelief, shock, rage, and powerlessness in her face. She didn't know what to do, what to make of it, and they're basically there trying to treat her daughter and what to do about this situation. And there were so many other patients throughout this hospital from different parts all around Iraq, including some wounded from Fallujah, including a little boy who had been wounded from grenade shrapnel that had went into his back. And again, they don't know what can they do about this situation. And this was just one snapshot in one day in one hospital in Baghdad, as the wounded from all of the attacks all around the country, whether they be Fallujah, Baghdad or all of these other cities that we see keep popping up into the news with fighting going on, being brought into the various hospitals, whether it be from direct fighting or people being wounded when car bombs go off or from haphazard shooting from U.S. soldiers. It's a bloodbath here, and the hospital is filled with the proof.
Yeah, Dar, the U.S.-backed interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, says that there are no casualties, Iraqi civilian casualties in Fallujah.
Well, it's really difficult to explain how the vast majority of Iraqis feel about U.S.-selected Prime Minister Alawi without using expletives. But I'll do my best. One man described it very well that I interviewed recently. He said, you know, if the U.S. pulled 100% out of Iraq and left Alawi, he would last maybe 1 hour here before he was killed. This man is doing a very splendid job of being a good puppet spokesperson for the Bush policy in Iraq. Him saying this is in direct contradiction of every single report of every single refugee who's come out of Fallujah, his own, well, I would go on a limb to call them countrymen, since Alawi himself hadn't lived in Iraq for 30 years before coming here. But every report from every relief worker coming from Fallujah, every report from refugees and people who'd been coming in and out of Fallujah long before the siege, just commenting on the bombing that had occurred there for months before the siege began. So for him to say this, it's the worst propaganda and one of the most blatant lies I've heard come out of Iraq in a long time.
Also, in your piece and about the hospital and the people who are there, you write about three Humvees pulling up as U.S. soldiers get out. What was the reaction in the hospital?
Yes, three Humvees had pulled up to discuss with some hospital officials if it would be okay if wounded from Fallujah were brought to their hospital, which, of course, wounded from Fallujah had already been brought to the hospital and for several days in a row. And while they were speaking with one of these officials who went out to talk with them, one of the doctors nearby started yelling expletives in them in Arabic. Of course, this wasn't translated to the soldiers, but my translator right next to me translated all of it, and I managed to get a photo of the exchange. And the man was just—he couldn't contain his rage. He'd been treating patients for a long time, so many of them victims of U.S. aggression, and he started yelling, "Get the F out of here. We don't need you here. We don't need your help. Bring back Saddam. Even Saddam was better than you animals. We can take care of our own people, so just get the F out of here."
You write about how the translator dealt with that.
I'm sorry?
You write about how the translator, your translator, dealt with what they were screaming.
Yes, I was a little bit off to the side, wasn't right in that group when it went off, but I could hear it, especially since this one individual was yelling. But the Iraqi translator that the military had brought with them sat there with just a stone face while this man was yelling at the soldiers and, of course, didn't translate it.
So the translator for the U.S. soldiers wouldn't translate what they said back to what the Iraqis were shouting back at the soldiers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Dar Jamal, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Independent journalist currently based in Baghdad, one of the only independent unembedded journalists in Iraq right now. He publishes his reports on a blog called DarJamalIraq.com, and you can connect to it through our website at democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll hear from Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani about what's happening in Fallujah. Stay with us.
Until the philosophy which old one raised superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war. that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Mr. War, that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. And it's a war that until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality.
Bob Marley, War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in the country, as we broadcast on over 300 radio and TV stations and both satellite networks, Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, and 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, Link TV. Looking forward to seeing people in Pittsburgh today at Carnegie Mellon at 4:30 and in the evening at the Thomas Merton Center. I'm Amy Goodman. The situation in Iraq is continuing to grow bloody by the day. The unelected interim government of Iyad Alawi continues its crackdown on the Iraqi media. Last week, Alawi's government threatened media organizations that don't report on the Iraqi government's spin on the siege of Fallujah, saying reporters must differentiate between, quote, innocent civilians or innocent citizens of Fallujah who are not targeted by the military operations, and between the terrorist groups who infiltrated the city and took its people hostage under the pretext of resistance and jihad, unquote. But these instructions to journalists appear to be contradicted by the U.S. military's own statistics. Earlier this week, the military said of the roughly 1,000 prisoners taken in Fallujah, only 15 are believed to be foreigners. The Iraqi government also warned journalists not to add patriotic descriptions to members of the Iraqi resistance. Journalists were told to underscore that, quote, these military operations did not come about until all peaceful means were attempted, unquote. It's unclear what will happen to news organizations that break the new guidelines. Meanwhile, stark differences continue in how the embedded correspondents report on the siege of Fallujah and how Arab media are covering the U.S. offensive. While most reports on U.S. networks focus on what they call the house-to-house fighting in Fallujah, Arab media are showing images of bodies piled in the streets, dead children, corpses covered by flies decomposing. One of the few unembedded correspondents in the city, an Arab reporter from the BBC, has described a stench in areas of Fallujah from the dead bodies. One of the most influential networks in the world, Al Jazeera, has been banned from Iraq. Earlier this week at a forum in New York, the New York Times coverage of U.S. on the U.S. The New York Times coverage of U.S. foreign policy, Professor Mahmoud Mamdani of Columbia University addressed the situation in Fallujah. Mamdani is the author of Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, America, the Cold War, and the Roots of Terror. Here is Professor Mahmoud Mamdani.
For the last week, I have been thinking of the city of Fallujah. And thinking about Fallujah has not been easy while one reads the New York Times. I looked for an article which would tell me something about the history of resistance in the city of Fallujah. I didn't find it in the Times. I found it in The Guardian in London. And The Guardian piece told me that this resistance began with the massacre of April 28, 2003, when parents and children in a school which had been occupied by American soldiers had started demonstrating, and 18 of them were killed in cold blood, 60 were injured, and began the resistance to the U.S. occupation in Fallujah. Before that, not a bullet had been fired. I then began to look for a story on the history of repression. Again, I didn't find it in the Times, but I found it in The Independent. And The Independent of London informed me that actually the best model, the model most suited to the kind of operation that was going on in Fallujah, I thought it was Jenin, but actually the Independent informed me it wasn't really Jenin, but it was the town of Hama in Syria, where in 1982 the Muslim Brotherhood had taken over the town and had called on the population to rise up against the government of Assad. And the government surrounded the town with tanks, weaponry, and simply demolished it. 10,000 civilians died. One of the aftermath of that operation was that the U.S. State Department put the government of Syria on its list of terrorist governments. And the next operation now to evoke Hama is what is just going on in Fallujah. I speak about Fallujah also because I think that it's symptomatic of a larger development. And I think that that development is best understood by contrasting our present current times with the situation in during the war in Vietnam. I think of Western empires, contemporary Western empires, and the American empire also as distinct from empires of old, even distinct from the Soviet empire in one way, which is that they tend to combine despotism abroad with democracy at home. And to the extent that they do so, to the extent that democratic institutions at home democratic life, to that extent, these empires can be potentially self-correcting. And this was seen during the Vietnam period in the sense that there was a powerful anti-war movement, and it was institutionally anchored, one, in the media, and two, in the universities. Well, a lot has changed since the Vietnam War, and the change is reflected very well in the media. It is, I think, partly a result of a political shift. Successive administrations since defeat in Vietnam held the media responsible for the defeat. After the killing fields of Cambodia, this accusation had a ring of truth in it, because the accusation was that you exposed our atrocities, but you didn't expose their atrocities. Since Cambodia, the tendency of the media has been to listen to and relay the administration's version of their atrocities. And this trend came to a glorious conclusion with embedded reporters in Iraq. Partly, there has also been a change in the marketplace, and the change in the marketplace is a change of ownership. Big corporate media has come to be owned, in some cases by Hollywood, in other cases by defense contractors. For Hollywood, news has become entertainment, and defense contractors are shy of debates. The result, I think, for the American polity is a shrinking of the democratic arena, most evident in the recent elections. I noted that in the debates, neither Abu Ghraib, nor Guantanamo, nor Fallujah were ever matters of discussion. More and more political issues are framed in a language of no choice. They are framed in a language of evil. They are framed in a language of religion. The language of evil also began, the current round of the language of evil follows defeat in Vietnam. Ronald Reagan, speaking before the American Association of Evangelicals, recast the Soviet Union as an evil empire, and I think we should be quite aware, quite alert to the political uses of the notion of evil, the fact that evil is something with which one cannot coexist, the fact that the war against evil is a permanent war, it must go on until either victory or death. You can hear echoes of the war on terror in this. And the language now, of course, is much more a language of culture. After 9/11, I was struck by reports in the New York Times about how the Quran had become a bestseller item, how more and more Americans were going to bookshops to buy the Quran to get an understanding of the motivation of those who had hit the Twin Towers. And I wonder if the people of Fallujah are trying to find Bibles to read to understand the motivation. And I think not. And I think the reason lies not in the people of the U.S. The reason lies in the public debate and the public intellectuals and the way they have framed the public debate in this country. They have framed it in a culture talk. They have framed it with the supposition that it's the culture of a people which is a clue to their politics, except the peoples of the world are divided into three. There are those whose politics is simply their body and is explained as a biological politics of tribalism. There are others whose politics is their community, understood as religious community. And then, of course, there is the Western world whose culture is historical, who make their culture, who are not trapped in their culture like the rest of the world. Well, let me conclude. I know it's 5 minutes, and I just want to say in conclusion this is symptomatic of a larger crisis. And I believe the larger crisis is a crisis of the human rights movement. The human rights movement, which followed the end of the Second World War, was built on two presuppositions. One was that the violators of rights will be mainly third world countries, newly independent third world countries. And the second presupposition was that the enforcers of rights will be the big powers. Well, now we are in a world where the biggest power is the key major violator of rights. And in the face of this, I believe the human rights movement today is in a state of paralysis intellectually and politically. That is our challenge. Thank you.
Professor Mahmoud Mamdani of Columbia University, author of the book Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, America, the Cold War, and the Roots of Terror. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we move now to the issue of Tom DeLay. Emboldened by their success in the November 2nd election, Republicans in the House of Representatives yesterday changed their rules to allow Majority Leader Tom DeLay to keep his post even if he gets indicted. A Texas grand jury is investigating whether DeLay committed campaign finance violations in 2002 when he helped state Republicans gain control of the Texas State House. In September, a Texas grand jury indicted three political operatives with ties to DeLay, as well as eight companies that made donations to a political action committee created with help from DeLay. Wednesday's vote by GOP lawmakers was held behind closed doors and was unrecorded. It effectively overturns a 1993 party rule that requires leaders who are indicted to step down as leaders. DeLay told reporters Wednesday he doesn't expect to be indicted, but supports the rule change. The Republicans defended their vote, saying that Travis County District Attorney Ronnie Earle is on a partisan witch hunt against DeLay, and that all they're doing is taking steps to prevent Democrats from dictating the leadership of their caucus. DeLay himself says Earle is, quote, trying to criminalize politics and using the criminal code to insert himself into politics. DeLay is also deploying a team of Republicans to wage a PR war against the district attorney. New York's Peter King called Earle a runaway prosecutor, while Henry Bonilla of Texas labeled him a partisan crackpot district attorney. But in a recent New York Times profile of Earle, the paper points out during his tenure he's prosecuted 12 Democratic officials and 4 Republicans. Earle is quoted as saying, "The only people I antagonize more than Republicans are Democrats." House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi of California said, quote, "Republicans have reached a new low. It's absolutely mind-boggling that as their first order of business following the elections, House Republicans have lowered the ethical standards of their leaders." We turn to Lou DeBose, author of the new political biography on Tom DeLay called The Hammer: Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lou DeBose.
Glad to be here.
Can you explain what exactly Congress did yesterday?
Well, I think it's terribly embarrassing that the first act that they do is protect their leadership, and they're not worried about Hastert or Blunt being and Roy Blunt being indicted. They're worried about Tom DeLay, the very real possibility that he's going to be indicted. They passed the never been indicted. They lowered the never been indicted standard, and I think it signals that he's. If he weren't going to be, or if he weren't afraid, if there's not a real concern that he's going to be indicted here in Texas, why would they have done this? I think it's really an embarrassing moment for the Republican leadership.
Well, what about this idea of innocent until proven guilty?
Well, of course he's innocent until proven guilty, but they passed this rule, and I don't think that you want a leader indicted, an indicted member of the leadership, serving in the leadership while he's indicted. This is not a political witch hunt. Despite the overblown rhetoric, there's a very strong case that Ronnie Earl has. He has the facts and he has the law on his side. I'm turning up in the civil pleadings, Amy, a letter written to Tom DeLay from an Oklahoma corporation that says, "Dear Congressman DeLay, enclosed is the $25,000 that we promised from TrimPAC." Well, that's illegal. You can't raise corporate money and spend it in Texas on an election. It's very simple. The same is true of the New York Times, the Washington Post, an unrelated batch of documents, Enron memos, the Enron document dump, found DeLay asking for $150,000 from Enron, corporate and individual contributions to be used in Texas. So there's a real strong case here. And to dismiss it as a political witch hunt or the criminalization of politics is, I think, indicative of how desperate they are to try to intimidate a DA who's kind of the last man standing here in Texas.
You've also written an interesting piece about Alberto Gonzalez, the nominee to be Attorney General, the White House counsel for President Bush. Can you just briefly summarize it?
Yeah, I mean, the frightening thing about Al Gonzalez is that the unsettling thing about Albert Gonzalez is, you know, this is a transactional corporate lawyer who the Bushes found in V&E and Vincent and Elkins, which is Enron's law firm, but they're everybody's law firm. That's not that big a deal. But, you know, he has had very, very little limited legal experience, and they shaped him into what they wanted him to be. He's kind of a brown Pygmalion, a Hispanic. They wanted a Hispanic. They got a Hispanic. You know, smart guy, Harvard law, good family, Catholic, Roman Catholic, you know, Christian values, but limited legal experience, and his only boss has been George W. Bush. He's never said no to Bush. So consequently, when Bush wants a torture memo for, you know, can we suspend the Geneva Conventions, he says yes, as he did. This is the guy who's now the Attorney General and supposed to be in line for the Supreme Court, and his entire career in public service has been shaped by George W. Bush. That's when he's been his only boss.
Finally, the significance of all of these cabinet appointments that President Bush is making now, being his closest, the inner circle of the White House, many of them coming with him from Texas. What does this mean?
It means that it's all yes from. I mean, that this was Al Gonzalez. I mean, Albert Gonzalez is real, and he's a terrific guy. He's a decent guy, but he is a yes man. He, you know, this means that the dissent in the cabinet, that the robust argument that one would expect in a cabinet or from White House advisors, with the departure of Colin Powell, is now gone. You know, don't look for Al Gonzalez, or you know, the new White House counsel is Harriet Meyer. Well, she was George Bush's personal lawyer when he was doing baseball deals, and when he was dealing with legal affairs in Texas. He has essentially brought the family together to surround him, and that the real danger is with Margaret Spelling. She was a school board administrator, a school board lobbyist here in Texas. You know, all these people are people whose political careers who are in Washington because, just like George Bush and Karl Rove, they're in Washington because Bush brought them there. So, you have a lack of the echo chamber is a Washington political cliche, but you have no one to say no to the president, and this is a president very obviously who needs someone to say no to him or to say, wait a minute, Mr. President, this is not the right advice. Well, that's all gone.
Lou DuBose, I want to thank you for being with us, author of the new political biography of Tom DeLay called The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. I'd like to do it again.
This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the 25th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre. Stay with us.
I was born by the river in a little tent. The river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, I wish I could come out there where you are, baby. A long time coming, but I know, look at here, a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Look at here. Let me say one more thing. Somebody keep telling me, oh boy, don't hang around. It's been a long, a long.
Change is going to come. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, I'm Amy Goodman. On November 3rd, 1979, at the corner of Carver and Everett Streets, black and white demonstrators gather to march through Greensboro, North Carolina, a legal demonstration against the Ku Klux Klan. A caravan of Klansmen and Nazis pull up to the protesters and open fire. 88 seconds later, five demonstrators lie dead, 10 others wounded from the gunfire, recorded on camera by four TV stations. Four women have lost their husbands. Three children have lost their fathers. After two criminal trials, not a single gunman has spent a day in prison, although a civil trial won an unprecedented victory for the victims. For one of the only times in U.S. history, a jury held local police liable for cooperating with the Ku Klux Klan in a wrongful death. That's the introduction to the book, Through Survivors' Eyes, From the 60s to the Greensboro Massacre, written by one of the survivors, Sally Bermanson. This month marks the 25th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre. Today we speak with two of the survivors. But first, let's go back to that fateful day, 25 years ago.
We can take our country back from the Communist Party. We can take it back from the niggers. It's time for us to band together. If we have to get in the streets and fight in blood up to our knees, by God, it's time to get ready to fight. Give them what they want. Fight for this country.
Yes, sir.
The Klan or whoever it was jumped out and just started shooting in the direction of the thickest concentration of people. They seemed to be aiming at particular people. There were several police in the area who did nothing until after these murderers left.
police came in immediately and started arresting people who were trying to help those who had fallen. Nelson Johnson, you know, was taken into custody, kicked in the head by the police. He was bleeding from the arm as he was trying to help people. I mean, the police did this, directly or indirectly. They set it up.
This will never happen again. We will never be at home. He didn't even have a gun on him. He didn't even have a gun on him.
Images and sounds of the 1979 Greensboro massacre brought to us courtesy of Jim Waters, one of the camera people that day, put together a piece called The Guns of November 3rd. This month marks the 25th anniversary of the Greensboro massacre. Last weekend, as many as 700 people marched to Greensboro City Hall following the Root of the Plan 79 march. They finished the march that never was completed 25 years ago. The survivors of the Greensboro massacre are forming the country's first Truth and Reconciliation Commission based on the South African model. We're joined by Reverend Nelson Johnson, survivor of the Greensboro massacre, one of the organizers of the anti-Klan rally of 1979, now the executive director of the beloved Community Center in Greensboro. Also in our studio here in New York, Sally Bermanson, one of the survivors also of the massacre, in which her husband Paul was critically wounded. She's now associate professor of politics at Brooklyn College, where she teaches classes on politics, race, and gender. And she has authored the book Through Survivors' Eyes, The 60s Through the Greensboro Massacre. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Sally Bermanson, the beginning of the video audio clip that we just played. We heard a man, you know, talking about going after African-Americans, using the N-word. Who was he?
His name was Virgil Griffin. He was he is still a leader of a Klan, and he was in the lead car that came in and attacked our march.
So that man that we saw addressing a crowd,
yes,
that was, you had footage of,
yes,
came then and attacked the protest. Why the protest? Well, let me put that question to Reverend Nelson Johnson, since you were one of the organizers of it. Why did you protest that day on November 3rd? Where were you trying to get to? From where to where?
Well, essentially the same place we should be trying to get to now, that we were actually doing labor organizing and racial justice organizing, and the Klan, and that way of thinking, whether it's named Klan or not, resisted that. And one of the most virulent forms of trying to create fear and promote falsehood and engender confusion through the threat and the use of force has been the Klan. It was so very important and is so very important that people who stand for justice resist this. So the short answer is that it was absolutely necessary to have some expression of opposition to racism as manifest by the Klan in order to continue with the work of labor organizing in the textile industry, and in order to continue with the work of uniting people from different racial backgrounds. Those questions were necessary, and that was at the base of the reason for the march in 1979.
Sally, so explain how it went down that day on November 3rd. What time did you gather?
We gathered. The march was supposed to start at noon. At 11:23, while we were just gathering before the march began, this caravan drove up and opened fire.
Did you know anything was going to happen?
No, we had no idea. It was we had a legal police permit. The police were supposed to be there to protect the march like they do for every other march. There were no police around. Actually, there were police who were following the caravan in, who knew its every move as it approached us. They knew that it had guns. They had watched them all morning. They were in direct contact with the headquarters, police headquarters. They followed this death squad as it approached us, as it pulled out guns and opened fire and killed five people. So there actually were police there, although they were not in uniform, and they did nothing to protect the demonstrators, even though that was their obligation.
What happened to your husband, Paul?
He was shot in the head and the arm. He is still partially paralyzed from that. He had 5 hours of surgery that night. It was wonderful that he survived. It was a surprise that he survived.
Reverend Nelson Johnson, did you recognize people who were shooting you?
I did not. I later came to understand that one of the men who was driving the lead vehicle had been at a press conference that we held, and he was the agent of the Greensboro Police Department, who was also a Klansman and an informant for the FBI. And he was the person to whom the Greensboro Police Department gave the parade permit either before or at about the same time that it was given to us. And that is a long story that I won't get you into, but it was hard for us to get the parade permit and all the clearances. And there were never any reason given other than people were out of town and things that just doesn't work for a government. That's not the way a government works.
Reverend Johnson, what happened to you that day?
Well, I actually was very close to Sally Bermerson, and a Nazi member charged me with a knife, and fortunately someone threw me a stick, and I was defending myself. So I got cut about the hands and stabbed through the arm as the person was trying to cut my midsection.
In the video footage, we see the police going after you. Is that right?
Well, because I negotiated the parade permit with the police, I perhaps more than anyone else was pretty clear that the whole arrangement that we made with the police had been betrayed. And I stood up to say that there isn't any way that this could happen without the police. And the police then came and demanded that I be quiet, and when I refused to do so, they arrested me, threw me to the ground, and the man who became the police chief had his foot on my neck, and I was bleeding pretty profusely at the time from the knife wound, so that may be some of what you're referring to.
Did they arrest you?
Mm-hmm. They arrested me and held me, did not set a bond. As a matter of fact, I've had 7 charges brought against me directly growing out of the incident of 1979. And I have been in jail under a bond twice that of any Klans person. I was once in jail for $150,000, allegedly for using bad language. And Klansmen were in for murder for $50,000. So if you work with that, it gives you a sense of the atmosphere, which was unbelievable, except for those of us who were in it. It's not something that I often share in detail because it doesn't really make sense to many people around the country.
Sally Bermerson, we only have a minute, and I wanted to ask about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's the first in this country. Explain what's happening.
Well, it's a project of the broad sectors of the Greensboro community, the religious sectors from all different types of religious groups, the universities, the student governments, civic and civil rights organizations, as well as the survivors have been very involved in it. It's the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the United States, and it's also the first one worldwide that is based in a city that's a individual community process. I think that it's a wonderful model that could address all kinds of other racial violence that this country has been so plagued by for hundreds of years.
The former mayor of the city, Jim Melvin, is opposed to the formation of this?
Yes, he is.
Why?
Well, he was the mayor when this happened. It was his police who did not protect the demonstrators, and he played a big role in at least covering up what had actually gone on.
Well, we hope to come back to the story. It's a very important one. I want to thank you both, Sally Bermanzon and Reverend Nelson Johnson, for joining us. Sally Bermanzon's book is called Through Survivor's Eyes, From the 60s to the Greensboro Massacre. It was just published. It's the 25th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. I'll see people in Pittsburgh later today at Carnegie Mellon in the afternoon and the Thomas Merton Center tonight. And then we head to Spain. We'll be broadcasting next week from Spain, Madrid, and from Rome, Italy. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can see the details. Thanks for joining us. Oh, yes, it will.